Anyway, I'm Harlan, and I am a compulsive overeater. And I am originally from Chicago, Illinois, but I now live in Scottsdale, Arizona, and I'm very glad to be there, too. I'm glad to be here. Oh, sorry about that. You can't hear my booming voice. Okay. Oh, the water. Oh, okay, thanks. You just saved me from embarrassment. Everybody would think I wet my pants. I probably could not. Is this on?
I have no idea.
Do
you want to put that on you?
It does.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah,
put that on my belt, huh?
All right.
Yeah. You know about these things a lot more than me, that's for sure. How about if I just stick it in my pocket here, this little pocket? Oh, here he is. Wait, here's the guy from the thing. Hi. I can restart if you want me to, but I don't know if this is on or off. No, do not all do that, George. No. Okay, is this on? Is this rolling here? Okay. Oh, I have to carry this too, I guess? I got plenty of cable. I feel like a something or other. I don't know. It's down over there. Okay. I'm just going to stick it in my pocket here. I don't know. Maybe. But I don't know. What do I know? Okay. Anyway, I probably could not have helped being a compulsive overeater. It was probably my predestined fate. My mom and dad were both very, very compulsive overeaters, and my mom was very out of touch with herself. She had a lot of mental illness, and on the day that I was born in 1954, my mom had no clue that she was even pregnant. And when I say that in a room full of ladies, I always get the kind of look that I just saw. They're very surprised by that. But that really just kind of illustrates how out of things my mother was. And she had a lot of mental illness. And by the time I was probably 4 or 5 years old, she was pretty much gone to me. My dad was 54 years old on the day that I was born. My dad walked out of Europe when Europe was a graveyard, when the world had gone crazy and the world had just gone nuts. And he came out of these things, and murder and mayhem were a very, very much real part of his life. They were very much something that scarred him, defined him, and injured him until the day he died. When I was a little boy, very, very quickly, I became a compulsive overeater because food did something for me that it wasn't doing it for other people. What food did for me as a child was it gave me a little bit of calm in the storm. And my mother and father screamed and yelled at one another incessantly. My home was like a battleground all the time. And there was always massive amounts of food, massive quantities of food being served. And the eating was just incessant. A meal was just a break between binges, between snacking, between constant grazing. And this was how I grew up. But there was one time, there was one instance where the fighting would stop. It would be like a calm before the storm was when the food was on the table for a meal, which was a break between the binges, as I said. By the time I was about 3 or 4 years old, I was my mother's husband and my father's wife. What I mean by that is not something that has anything to do with a sexual sense. But when I was 3 or 4 years old, my mother would come home, or my mother would be home, rather, and she would say to me all the time, "I hate your father. The only reason I live here is because of you." And my father would come home and say, "I hate your mother. The only reason I live here is because of you." And all I really wanted to find out is if Yogi and Boo Boo Bear would get away with that picnic basket before Ranger Smith caught them. And so it became very, very confusing for me as a child to be in the middle of this. And what I didn't understand until I was an adult was how dysfunctional that really was. And I really was so ingrained in fear as a child, just absolute fear. My mother instilled a lot of fear in me. My dad instilled a lot of fear in me. My dad told me every single day of my life, without exception, when they came to kill me, I wasn't home. One day, they'll come to kill you. And if they don't kill you, they'll kill your children. And I'm 4 years old hearing this every single day. And that did a lot of things to my fear, and it did a lot of things to my little mind that I did not know how to handle. But there was one time again where all things seemed calm and serene, and that is when I was full of food. And by the time I was 4 or 5 years old, it really was a situation where I started thinking about dieting. I started thinking about wanting to be someone else, to be somewhere else, and to be thinner. I wanted to be thinner. There were people yelling and screaming at my mother and father, why are you letting him eat so much? Why are you letting him eat so much? You've got to do something about his weight. And then when I got to be a little bit older, they started yelling and screaming at me about the food I was eating. People would start accosting me about, why are you eating that candy bar? Why are you eating that? That's not on your diet. And people would load me full of things that would shame me and scare me. Another few things that they would say to me, well-intentioned people would say to me is, don't eat so much. Girls don't like fat boys. I found that out. They said, don't eat so much. You'll feel better. They said things to me like, if you eat that candy bar, you'll never get a good job. And on and on and on and on. I was a bedwetter until I was probably about 12. I was just scared the bejesus out of me all the time. But there was one thing I knew that I wanted, and I wanted that food. I wanted that fix. I wanted to eat. And as much as I wanted not to, I always succumbed to that temptation. I always succumbed against my will. And people would say, well, what do you mean it was against your will? I did not want to be eating that food. And then all of a sudden, that voice inside of me that we all know said, oh, come on, just this one time and tomorrow you'll be okay. By the time I was about 8 years old, I went to a doctor, Dr. Jacobson in Chicago, and he gave me diet pills. No, I was about nine. Excuse me. I was 9 years old, and I was on 500 milligrams of very heavy amphetamine 3 times a day. I'm 9 years old at this time, and I am on 1,500 milligrams of amphetamine, and they were right about one thing. Man, does that kill your appetite. Woo-wee! But when that pill wears off, I ate Illinois and most of Wisconsin. Anything that wasn't nailed down, I would eat incessantly. I can still remember not sleeping, and I can still remember getting in physical fist fights at school. That's not me. I'm an eater. I'm not a fighter. And I'm getting in these fist fights, and my wife accuses me of this now, but I would be saying the same thing 400 times. And even in my little brain, I'm saying, why am I saying that again? Why am I doing that again? I didn't really understand that that was one of the effects of that heavy amphetamine is your brain is kind of, my brain was kind of disconnected from what was going on, and I would say the same thing again and again. Then when I was about 10 years old, they started coming out with some of the information about these amphetamines. So all they basically did was they changed me from a pink pill to a blue pill, 250 milligrams 4 times a day instead of 500 milligrams 3 times a day, and it was exactly the same effect. You don't eat, and when the pill wears down, when the pill starts coming down, you eat everything. Everything was a fight with me as a child. I did long-term school assignments the morning they were due by copying out of the encyclopedia. Everything was procrastinated, and that created an emergency. The procrastination would create more of a problem than if I had just faced my problem head on and done what I was supposed to do, and that became a lifelong thing until I got into recovery. My mother was, as I say, when I was a kid, she was very, very lost to me. She loved me. My dad loved me. But by the time I was in grammar school, my dad was 60 years old, which was older than many of the grandparents of my friends. I never had grandparents, cousins, aunts, uncles, brothers, or sisters, and I was always kind of jealous of the kids who did. I always kind of envied that they had something that I didn't really have. But there was one thing that I could not deny, and that was I wanted to be them. I was very jealous as a child. I wanted Rob and Laura Petrie for parents, you know? I wanted that image, that life. I wanted young, American, rich, thin, good-looking parents, and, you know, and I didn't get that. I got something very, very different. And if you're here tomorrow morning, I'll talk about how my relationship with my folks has changed over the years. When I was in high school and I hit puberty, things started really racing past me much quicker, much faster. And the ability that I had to touch what was right in front of me in terms of life was becoming more and more elusive. I always kind of looked at life through a fence, you know. I always sort of thought, these people out there, they know something or they're in on some kind of a secret and no one told me. I always was judging my insides by their outsides. I always thought they had painless, fear-free, wonderful lives, and I just couldn't reach out and grab it. There was just something barring me from that. And when I hit puberty, it really started to get beyond me. And you know how you hear the stories of the 60s, how everybody wanted to do their own thing and everybody wanted to be different? Not me. I was a fat kid. I was different enough. I wanted to look like the other kids. I wanted to wear Levi's. I wanted to wear Madras shirts. I wanted to wear the clothes that they wore. And, you know, in the 1960s, you didn't have the big and tall. And it wouldn't have looked the same anyway, trust me. By the time I was in high school, I was 335 pounds as a senior in high school. And, you know, I had to wear clothes. I had to wear anything. If it covered me and it fit, and we could afford it, I bought it. And frequently I'd be wearing pants or I'd be wearing shirts that went out of style during the Depression. You know, because my dad would go down to the neighborhood in Albany Park there in Chicago, and he would buy me clothes from a guy who was selling them, you know, to these old guys. And, you know, that's all. And I remember a couple of times during my life, this happened more than once, there would be like, I would have like three or four pair of pants that fit. They'd all be the same color and they'd all be the same size and the same everything. So it really looked as if I was wearing the same pair of pants for years at a time incessantly. And that really bothered me too. I couldn't look like the other kids and I couldn't really do some of the things that they were doing too. But I believe that when God closes a door, I didn't have family, cousins, aunts, uncles, that kind of thing. There's another door that opens. It may be a little painful waiting in the hallway for a while, but what I did have was wonderful friends, and I remain very lucky today to have some of those friends that I've known for 40 and 50 years, and it's a wonderful part of life, and it's something that I'm very, very grateful for. By the time I was in my teens, I could really see that my mother and father were really declining very seriously and very rapidly, and I was declining too, and we were really a mess. In my last days together with them when we were all in adult years, we were about 1,100 pounds between three adults. My mother was about 300, my father was about 275, 260, something like that, and I was over 500 pounds at the end of their life on earth. So we were about 1,100 pounds between three people, and we were just as crazy could be. There was some love in that family, but there was so much injury that there was no functionality to that love. There was just no functionality to that family dynamic. And when I was 22 years old, I graduated high school in 1972. When I was 22 years old, I was in college, and I really couldn't go away. There was a lot of reasons for it. A lot of it was the fact that I was so busy eating. I never did well in school. I tested well, but I didn't do well because I didn't do the homework and so on. But when I was 22 years old, my mom died, and it was merciful for her because she had suffered so long. She was an amputee from diabetes. She was a dialysis patient when dialysis in the 1970s was very new, and it was horrible. It was just merciful that she went. And when I was 24 years old, my dad passed away. My dad passed away of cancer. So I had several years there of tremendous, tremendous trauma. And when I was 24 years old, I really was ill-equipped to go out and fare forth into the world as a functional adult. I was 500, 600 pounds at that time. I was broke. They left me with nothing. I had no skills. I had nothing. And I became very, very enmeshed in my eating disorder. I became very enmeshed in suicidal thoughts. I really had believed at times in my life, for sometimes years at a time, that I would have been better off dead, that I would have been better off never having been born. I was lonely. I was to go on my first date with a girl when I was 35 years old. I was very lonely. I was very broke, and I was confused, and I was only sure of two things. I wanted to eat. I didn't care who knew, and I was just done fighting it anymore. I spent my whole life in one of two states of being, eating or not eating. Eating, meaning I don't care who knows it, screw you, or not eating. And that means literally, not but figuratively, hanging from the ceiling, white-knuckle dieting, and with every fiber of my soul, I would stay away from food for periods of time. There were times when I would diet very successfully, and there were things that I tried as a child, backing up a little bit, even as a child. I was a Weight Watcher king. I went down to the Pitt Congress Hotel, downtown Chicago, and they put a sash on me, and I lost the weight, and I'm, you know, like Miss Illinois or something like that. And there were times when I would go to Tops, T-O-P-S, I don't even know if they still have that, lose weight with AIDS. Remember those AIDS candies, A-Y-D-S candies? You know, you eat one candy and it kills your appetite, so you eat the whole box. You know, what the hell, right? If one's good, 82 of them are much better. And man, you want to talk about a case of sitting in the bathroom, you eat some of those AIDS candies, man. You'd be in there for a long time. And those were some of the things I tried to do to fend off this vicious and crippling and fatal illness. And there was, of course, no way that I could do that alone. And when I was 24 years old, when my dad died, I was very ill prepared. I lied when the truth would have been better. I had a food habit in the 1970s, a food habit, not a cocaine habit, not a gambling habit, a food habit in the 1970s of about $100 to $150 per day. I was making nowhere near that kind of money. I was writing bad checks. I was lying. I was passing checks, out of my dead mother's bank account, out of my dead father's bank account. I was lying to myself and lying to anyone in my environment. I was a taker. I was a sieve. I was absolutely out here to get money or something from someone else so I could go and score food. And there was no way in this world that I knew how to function as an adult. I stunk. I was absolutely filthy dirty. I was at a point where my weight was escalating so quickly that my skin was bursting. This disease took from me everything that you can take from a person. And if this illness did anything, it beat me to crap. It beat me down. If I did those things to you, I'd be in prison. I was so afflicted with contact dermatitis, where the skin would be, the flab of skin from the fat would be so overwhelming that my skin would be red and angry, and I wasn't bathing, and I stunk, and I was filthy dirty. I couldn't even wear underwear anymore. I had rolls of towels between the rolls of flab, and that's how I functioned. And those towels would get that infected pus in there. And my edema in my lower legs was so profuse, I started to get nickel and dime and penny size holes in the back of my calves. And I have scars there today. And the discoloration is there today. And I could not lay flat in a bed and breathe. Because if I laid in a bed to breathe, I would stop breathing and die. I had to sleep in a chair, which exasperated the edema. I was broke. I broke furniture. I broke my friend's waterbed. I broke car interiors. I broke couches. I broke chairs. I fell down when I broke furniture. It was one of the most embarrassing moments I could ever think of when I broke my friend's waterbed. What manner of embarrassment escaped me, I do not know, but all I know is I had had enough and I wanted to die. In 1979, two friends came through my home, which was filth. I lived in filth and squalor. And they pushed their way past the candy wrappers and the pizza boxes and the containers of empty, or the empty containers where Chinese food had been. And they came in and they said, "We're going to an OA meeting." And I said, "What?" The jig was up. My friends had become my creditors, and the jig was up. I had to go. And so I came. In 1979, I came to a meeting of Overeaters Anonymous at the Orchard Mental Health Center. God likes to laugh, too. The Orchard Mental Health Center in Skokie. I ate my way to the meetings. I prayed for a Russian airstrike during the meetings, and I would eat my way home. I came into those rooms, and I did not doubt that I was a compulsive overeater, but I wondered what was up with you. Because when I looked around that room those nights in 1979, I saw a picture that is very similar to what I see right now. Normal looking people, and I was 15, 20 years younger than anybody in that room, and 300 to 400 pounds fatter than anybody in that room. And I did not wonder why I was there. I wondered why you were. You had been married. You had had sex. You had had a car. You had a house. What were you doing here? Your life was perfect. And if I had your life, I wouldn't be here. Because if I had your life, and if I had your car, and if I lived where you live, life would be a dream, wouldn't it? But they were there. And things started happening that I did not expect. First thing that happened was I stopped smoking. I didn't come here to stop smoking, but that's what happened. I stopped smoking in 1980. 1979, 1980, 1981, and a little bit of 1982, and I'm losing weight, and I'm going to meetings, and I'm going to conventions, and it is fantastic. And things started happening, but what I was really doing was not having a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. I was dieting with group support. I was going into the meetings and getting all charged up not to compulsively overeat, and I'm going to be good today as opposed to bad. There were some other things that started happening too. I started realizing, though, that there was a place I could go. And there were people who connected with me, which is so much of an important part of my story. I remember it was a Thursday night at Swedish Covenant Hospital, and there was a woman there named Della F., and I'm still friendly with Della today. And Della F. was a housewife in Chicago with what was then two toddlers. She was married. What do I have in common with Della? Nothing. But she told my story. She spoke about food and her reactions to food and her reactions to life, and she said things in her lead at Swedish Covenant Hospital on a Thursday night that I believed were secret unto me. That I was the only person in the world who thought those thoughts. I was the only person in the world who did those things. I was the only person in the world who reacted that way or who feared that way. Ego will always call me out from the group and make me different. God will make me a part of, and all of my life, when I felt apart from the group, it was my ego, but I didn't know it. Because the ego is the worst source of information, and the best source of selling it to me is the truth. It always lies, and it always fools me. My wife defines humility as being the God-given ability through work to be one of many. To be one of many. To be part of the group rather than apart from it. And I always saw myself apart from the group, but that was breaking down. And I got scared. And I wasn't working steps. And in 1981, I graduated from Overeaters Anonymous. And they played the graduation song, "Welcome to McDonald's. May I take your order, please?" Every time I graduated, they played the same song, "Welcome to McDonald's. Can I take your order, please?" When Harold Washington was elected mayor, it was April the 4th, 19... 83. I had graduated from my first stint in OA, and I was running a fever that was through the ceiling, and I couldn't even function. The edema was so bad because I had put massive quantities of weight back on. I was sick. I was sore. My legs were so bad from the edema. It was unbelievable. And I came into Skokie Valley Hospital, and they checked me in, and they weighed me. I was 513 pounds on that day. And they said to me that they thought that possibly I had gangrene and they may have to take off my left leg. They said that some of these cells are looking pre-gangrenous, and if we think they're gangrenous, we're going to have to go in. I'm 513 pounds, and I can remember that whole scenario. And one of the things that sticks in my mind is, you know how when you go into the hospital, they give you these very flattering robes, these things? Well, it looked like I was wearing a faded blue tie, because the thing that they give you, the robe, it just kind of covered my chest. That's how huge I was at 513 pounds. My fever was 106, and the nurse and the doctor said, if it gets to 108, we're going to lose you. 108 is like the cutoff point. And they did everything they could do, but cellulitis and staph infection are viral. They're not bacterial. And as that infection was coursing through my veins, they tried everything they could to stem it. And I laid on that bed with intravenous tubes in my arm, and they had to put me in a private room because what they had to do was they had to brace a bed against a wall so that I wouldn't break it. Every bed I had at home, which was one bed, was broken. It was busted because beds are not made to carry or to hold somebody flopping down on them at 513 pounds. They didn't want their hospital bed to break. And so I was in a private room, and on the chart, which my friends showed me when they came to visit me, they wrote at the bottom where it said, weight, 513 pounds. They wrote on there, weight is not mistake. This man is huge. They didn't want anybody picking up 513 pounds and thinking that certainly must be a mistake. So they had to make a notation. That was Monday. Tuesday was the mayoral election. And Tuesday, my memory's fading a little bit, I'm getting older, they came into my room, and I can still see that nurse's face today. It was about 10 p.m., and they were getting awful, awful itchy to take off my leg. And as you can see, they didn't. But she said to me something that was a very, very sweet thing, because I had laid on that bed for 2 days crying like a baby. I was crying like a baby. Where am I going to go now? What am I going to do now? Who's going to take care of me? What am I going to do? I'm going to have one leg. Why was I born? And I begged God, and I sung our national anthem. God, get me out of this one, and I'll never eat like this again. God, get me out of this one, and I'll never eat like this again. And that nurse came up to my room at about 10 o'clock at night, and I can see her now. And she said, 99. One of the sweetest things I had ever heard in my life, because that meant that what they were doing was working, that the flow of the infection was beginning to stem, that the flow of the infection was beginning to get beat back by my natural defenses and whatever else they were putting in me. To illustrate how ill I was bodily and mentally, I left that hospital after a 15-day stay. You know how sick you got to be in a hospital for 15 days, even then? And when the insurance company, as a kind of a matter of course, picks up morbid obesity, they send a parade of well-intentioned and whatever informed people up to your room. And the first visit I got was from the nutritionist, and she was about 81 pounds, and she had a pen in her pocket that was kind of weighing her down. And she imparted advice on me that was life-changing. Here's what she told me. Don't eat dessert. I said, where have you been all my life? Now the psychologist comes up to my room, And if there's any nurses or psychologists or nutritionists in the room, please forgive me. The psychologist comes up to my room with some more sage advice. And what she told me, she was 93 pounds, what she told me was brilliant. What she said to me was, take a picture of something you really want, a goal, and put it on the refrigerator, and when you see the picture, you won't eat like that anymore. I said, "What? Where have you? Why aren't you in Washington? Why aren't you telling this to the world? My God!" And the doctor said to me something that changed my life. He said, "Why don't you do this? Whenever you're served food, just eat half." I thought, "You guys, why didn't I just come here when I was five? Why did I waste all this time and money and, you know, all this stuff on all these other things? I could have saved so much suffering if I would have just come here when I was like 5 years old." It was unbelievable. Now, here's the other part, because I said I was sick bodily. Not only that, I was sick mentally, because here's something that crossed my mind when I was 513 pounds. I thought to myself, you know, if I could just get down to about 450, that wouldn't be bad. And I really kind of believed that. That's how crazy I was. And when I left that hospital, I was a very, very svelte 468 pounds. And the ice on the parking lot in April of that year was about 2 inches thick. It was a freezing cold April. And if you've never lived in Chicago, you will not relate to this. Sometimes you have to use your air conditioner and your heater on the same day. So you have to really know that you've got to be prepared for freezing cold Aprils and Junes, and you just got to go with it. Now, when you are morbidly obese, as I was, one of the most beautiful side effects of that is fissures on the bottom of your feet where the skin cracks. It's a really beautiful thing, and if you've never experienced it, I don't wish it on you. But when I walked down into that parking lot, because, you know, I couldn't wear socks. I couldn't get them on. I couldn't get them off, and they cut into me so deeply from the edema that they were extremely painful, and they would often stink because what would happen is as the pus would run out the back of my leg, I told you this is a beautiful story. As the pus would run out of the back of my leg, it would wet them, and it would really, oh, it was just terrible. And I walked out into that parking lot, and I had just sung our national anthem, "God, get me out of this one. I'll never eat like this again. God, get me out of this one. I'll never eat like this again." But I had not had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. I had just dieted with group support and left OA. I had a 10 and 2 fives in my wallet. I put $3 worth of gas in the car, and I ate the other $17 on the way home, and I didn't come up for air till 1986. By this time, I'm way beyond 500 pounds, way beyond 600 pounds. I am roughly the weight of an adolescent manatee. And I am absolutely bereft of any type of life. I'm working on the phone as a salesman in an industry that I'm still in. But I was absolutely fractured. And I came in 1986 much, much more ready to do, not here, not just here, but to do what they were telling me. Because I was out of ideas. And if there's anything you're going to hear from me this weekend is, this is a program not for people who need it, not for people who want it, for people who do it. And there is only one way I will get ready to do it when I have been beat down by unmerciful food. Food is the great persuader. No, food is the only persuader. Because we're going to hear a little bit later this morning that frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. Food beat me down. And I cried uncle to the point where I would do, not think, not wish, do what they were telling me to do. And they pointed some things out to me that I needed to see. And some of those things are things we're going to be talking about as we go through the weekend, and I hope that you will hear something that you will that will help you too. But one of the things that they told me was step zero. Step zero is on page 58 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's on page 58, and it simply says, if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. And they changed that into some questions, some guys I knew, some people I knew. And what they said to me is, let's take that first thing, and they said, if you want what we have, and they said, do you? And then they said, what is it we seem to have that you want? And when I said to them things about losing weight and stuff, they dismissed that. They said, the secret here is not that we don't eat. The secret here is that by taking these actions, which he said, they said to me, you do not yet believe in, but we will encourage you to take them, you will not want to overeat. That's the magic. Not that we're not eating. If you put me on a desert island, I can't get the food. But when I work the steps, I don't want the food. And then they said to me, if you want what we have, and you're willing to go to any length to get it, are you willing to go to any length to get it? And that was the key. And I was just having breakfast this morning with somebody, and we were talking about this. I worked really hard at my illness. I worked really hard at getting the food, writing the bad checks, lying, convincing people that, no, you must have seen another 700-pound man getting out of a Chevrolet in front of Dunkin' Donuts. It couldn't have been me. I worked really, really hard at my illness, and when they asked me to do things for my recovery, I balked right away. And what they convinced me of was I was going to have to be ready to work as hard on my recovery as I was working on my illness. And then they said, then you are ready to take certain steps. And they pointed something else out. They pointed out that the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is the basic text of our recovery. That this is what this is. That this is the instruction manual. And that I was not to ever think that this wasn't the answer, because it says, the forward to the first edition, it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And they said to me, are you hopeless? And I said, you bet I am. I was hopeless. I don't know what it is that calls a compulsive overeater like me to have to try every wrong answer before I will finally try the right answer. I had to turn over every answer that was wrong before I came in here and cried uncle. I don't know what that is in me. It's ego, I know. Okay. Hopeless state of mind and body. And we're going to get into that this morning. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. For them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. We think this account of our experiences will help everyone to better understand the alcoholic. Many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person. And besides, we are sure that our way of living has its advantages for all. So that clears me up. That clears me up to that I don't have to question anymore, that there's 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And then they pointed out something that's on page XX in the fourth edition. Roman numeral 20 in the fourth edition, in the very first paragraph on Roman numeral 20, it says, of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, what does really trying mean? Going to 21 meetings and going out for coffee? No. Really trying means I'm working the program out of the big book and I'm doing steps with a sponsor who has a sponsor and I have a food plan that I'm working, and I'm sticking to it. Really tried means I'm really trying. 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. Other thousands came to a few AA meetings and at first decided they didn't want the program. But great numbers of these, about two of three, began to return as time passed. Now, those of you who have heard me before, I'm going to do a little preaching at this point in it because this is something that's important to me. that 75% recovery of the people who really tried, means work it out of the book and do the steps, 75% of those people recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I do not know what I do not know what meetings are like in other areas. I know what OA meetings are like in Chicago. I know what OA meetings are like in Scottsdale. I know what OA meetings are like in Phoenix, and I lived in Eugene, Oregon for 9 years too. We can't talk about 75% recovery, nowhere close to it. We can't talk about 50%, 25% recovery. We are lucky today where we are, if we can claim a percent and a half of the people who are walking into our doors that are getting recovery because they're not hearing it and they're not seeing it, and it's our responsibility to show it to them. And there's three things we can do for the still sick, suffering newcomer: recover, recover, and recover. Work it. Who is the newest person in this room this morning? Who is absolutely new? I think I know, but is there anybody in this room where this is their first OA meeting or real infancy? Is that your first one? I thought it was you. Okay. Could you give us your name? You're Rob? Rob, my entire being here in Los Angeles is dedicated to you, because you are the most important person in this room right now, because if we don't have you to pass this to, we will die. We will die. And you're new? I dedicate this to you as well. How long have you been in?
9 days.
9 days. The two of you. The two of you. If we don't have people with 9 days and no days, we are screwed, because if this is not a program that you get by absorbing spiritual information. You can get this program by transmitting spiritual information. But there was a couple of other things they showed me that one of the things really scared the crap out of me, and that is on the middle of page 45. It's the thesis line in the big book. In the fourth edition, it's on page 45, and it very simply says, the main object of this book is to help you find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. And that's where I really wanted to run. This God thing, oh boy, not something I embraced. The God of my childhood was a God that I saw as someone I could not please nor get to. Everything I did was wrong. Everything I thought and said was wrong. I was less than the grade. I couldn't make the grade. And in the synagogue I attended as a child, I'm absolutely sure they talked about a loving, compassionate, wonderful, munificent God. But that information never got to my seat. I was presented with a God that was full of hellfire and brimstone. And if I rode my bike on Saturday, or I ate certain kinds of this, or I didn't do that, I was screwed, and I wanted no part of that God. Now, here's what I had to do. I had to unlock that image in my mind. I had to remove, and we're going to be talking about Bill's story this morning too. I had to remove that part of my brain, and I had to embrace a new and different God. Now, there are theologians, and there are historians, and there are writers, and there are philosophers whose life's work it is to define and hypothesize about what God is and what God isn't. Not my job. There are two things that I need to know about God today. There is one, and it's not me. Those are the two things I need to know. There is one, and it's not me. Now, I got abstinent in 86 by doing the work. I stopped doing the work in 92, 93, and went back out again. But today, I have 11 years of back-to-back abstinence. And I've lost a little over 500 pounds, which is the least of what... thank you. And my God, thank you. But it's really the least of what I'm about. Now, what is the nature of this? And I know that my kidneys and my bladder are going to demand a break at some point, but we do need to cover some material. So if you feel the need, go, but we are going to have to take a break at some point. It won't be right this second. But here's what I would like to do. If you would, turn to the doctor's opinion in the Roman numeral section. Now, in the fourth edition, that's on Roman numeral 25, XXV. It's Roman numeral 25. The doctor's opinion is a very important part of our life, of my life. The doctor's opinion is the knowledge on which everything is based. The first two steps of Overeaters Anonymous are not working steps. They are conclusions of the mind. And unless I have those conclusions in the mind, of the mind cemented in my psyche, I will not go on with the work. Step one comes to us from Dr. Silkworth. Step two from Dr. Jung. And 3 through 12 come to us from the Oxford group, which are a bunch of people practicing first century Christianity to the best of their ability. What is the doctor's opinion and why is it important? What's the big deal about the doctor's opinion? It's in the Roman numeral section, so there's a lot of people that don't even read it. Gluttony, compulsive overeating, and addictive behavior have been philosophized about and theorized about for 5,000-6,000 years. Solomon wrote of it. Solomon, the great king of Israel, theorized that gluttony and alcoholism, they didn't have the hard liquor like they have today, but they had wine and they had different things. He believed that it was an illness, but he couldn't prove it, and he had no cure for it. He had no remedy for it whatsoever. Around the time of William Shakespeare in England and around the 1640s, there was a man who was a doctor, and his name was Dr. Trotter. He lived in England, as I said. And Dr. Trotter, he believed that alcoholism, addiction, was an illness, but he had no cure for it, and he couldn't prove it. In the late 1920s, Dr. William Duncan Silkworth was working as a neurologist in New York City. William D. Silkworth was a neurologist. But in October of 1929, like most Americans, he lost everything he had when the stock market crashed on Black Tuesday. In October of 1929, he was broke. And he found himself at the door of Charlie Towns. And Charlie Towns was the head doctor and owner of the Towns Hospital in New York City, which at that time was the preeminent hospital for the treatment of alcoholism and drug addiction. The Towns Hospital was a place that Charlie Towns observed something that was to change our lives, change my life for sure. Dr. Silkworth observed many, many alcoholics, most of them men, and they would come in deplorable shape, and leave in good shape. And some of them would be right back that day, the next week, the next month. They would come back in worse shape than they had come in the first time. And some of these men would leave healthy and never come back again. And he observed that there was something different about these other men who kept coming in and out and in and out and in and out. He believed that there was something that set them apart, something that separated them. And he philosophized about something which was to change the world that we live in. He believed that it was an illness. He still didn't have a cure for it or a remedy for it, but he also put in something that no one else had ever considered. A physical component. Let's find out what he said, and let's find out what he believed. I'm on page XXV. We of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader would be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. Convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. Now that's a pretty powerful statement there and a pretty powerful promise. It's important. A well-known doctor, chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter. To whom it may concern, I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In late 1934, I attended a patient who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of a type I had come to regard as hopeless. And I just talked about that in my story. If you're sitting here with ideas about how you're going to do this yourself, control this yourself, edit this, take it cafeteria style, as Maxine talked about yesterday, I got to tell you, I'm not optimistic. You have to be, in my opinion, bereft of ideas. You have to be out of thought of how you're going to do this your way. And the only way for me to get there is to be hopeless, so that the God thing doesn't become difficult for me, because I got nowhere else to go. I got nowhere else to go. Hopeless can be a good thing, because it's a bottom. Excuse me. In the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. Again, another promise. I personally know scores of cases who were of the type with whom other method had failed completely. If you've got a diet in you that you're not convinced it's going to fail completely, you're going to try it. Just a matter of when. Had failed completely. Sorry about that. Okay, got to get off my hip. Okay. These facts appear to be of extreme medical importance because of the extraordinary possibilities of rapid growth inherent in this group. They may mark a new epoch in the annals of alcoholism. These men may well have a remedy for thousands of such situations. You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. Now, excuse me, where you're looking in the fourth edition, or if you have a third edition, you're going to see William D. Silkworth's name in there. In the very first edition, in the first, I believe it's 16 printings, he wouldn't allow his name to be in there because he was a member of the medical profession. And the medical profession and the American Psychiatric Association had not accepted alcoholism as an illness. And he told Bill Wilson, I'll write you the letter, but don't you dare put my name in there, because if you put my name in there, they'll run me clean out of the medical profession. Well, in 1955, when they did the second printing, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Medical Association, had accepted it as an illness, and so you see his name in there in all the subsequent printings. But in the very first printing of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and for several printings after that, forget it. He wouldn't allow them to do that. Now, here is something that is very, very key to the whole thing, and that is in the next part. Now, the physician, I'm continuing here, the physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. So he actually wrote two statements. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe. You're going to hear a lie in Overeaters Anonymous. Here's one of the lies you're going to hear. There's no musts in OA. Baloney. Read the book. And the word must appears in here, I believe, 72 times. So it's going to tell me this is what I must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. And this is the very first time that anyone philosophized that there was a physical component to this. Every other person who philosophized about this said it was a condition of the mind. It was a form of madness. It was a form of lack of commitment. It was laziness. It was stupidity. It was a lack of faith, lack of religion, and on and on and on. William Silkworth was the very first person that put a physical component to this, or what he's later going to call the allergy. Now, let's continue. Okay. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. It's an illness of the mind and the body with a spiritual remedy. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy, here's that word, to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. Here is something, ouch, here is something which I could never account for in my life. This is one of the most baffling things about my life until I got into recovery. In a normal person that I look at, they get all the food they want every time they sit down to a meal. In my life, there was never enough. If you put a pizza in front of me, it could have been as big as Illinois, and I would have looked into Wisconsin, Indiana, Kentucky, and Iowa to see if I could grab any of their pizza too. There was something else that was very strange that I did not understand, and I just thought they were better than me. I thought they were something. Wait. I did something here. I saw Maxine coming in, and I knocked this off. Okay. Okay. All right. There was something else that was extremely different about me. When they eat, they get all the food they want every time they sit down to a meal. In my body, the more I eat, the more I want. The more I want, the more I eat, and it's just endless. And at the end of my eating career, my food got real salty. It would be a Friday night. I'd be home. My friends would be out with girls or doing whatever they were doing. It would be a Friday night. And for some reason, I played crazy games in my head. And might be that I'm crazy. But the bottom line is, I would buy a whole lot of binge foods, and I would buy a whole lot of stuff that I wanted to get into. And for some reason, I'd play a game with myself that said, oh, I'm just going to eat a little bit of this, and I'm going to save it for tomorrow. And I'd be out, you know, in the kitchen, and I'd get a little of it, and I'd start eating it, and all of a sudden, something would happen. And I would start to cry because everything I wanted in my soul and everything I wanted in my body was to be like my friends and do the things that they were doing and going the places that they were going. Everything in my body and in my mind was screaming, no, no, no. And I would start to cry from the toes, cry from the toes, cry from the toes, and my food got awful salty. Because the minute I started eating the ice cream, or the minute I would start eating the chips, or the minute I would start eating whatever it was, the next thing I knew, it was gone. I could not control my food once I started eating it, and I could not keep away from the food now that I wanted to. And if I can't eat because of the allergy, and I cannot keep from eating because of the obsession of the mind or the strange mental twist, I am powerless over food. Let's examine it further. Though we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as an altruistic plane, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is still jittery or befogged. More often than not, it is imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached, as he has a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. Now, here's the other part of what the doctor wrote. It said, the subject presented in this book seems to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. I say this after many years' medical experience as medical director of one of the oldest hospitals in the country treating alcoholic and drug addiction. There was, therefore, a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute a few words on a subject which is covered in such masterly detail in these pages. And that would be the Towns Hospital in New York City, where Bill is hospitalized. We're going to learn in Bill's story three times. Now, I'm going to read this paragraph, and I'd like to read it twice, and I'm going to change some of the words which help me understand it just a little bit better. Now remember, when we're reading this paragraph, this is a paragraph that is being written by a physician. It is being written from his standpoint, his point of view. And it says, we doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. Let me read that paragraph one more time, and I'm going to just change some of the words, but I'm not going to change any of its meaning or intention, and see if it doesn't help you as it helped me. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of spiritual awakening was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond medicine's conception. What with doctors' ultra-modern standards, medicine's scientific approach to everything, doctors are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of God that lie outside our synthetic knowledge or their medical knowledge. What he's telling me there, he didn't know about a spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening, rather, sorry. He was not a man of religion. He didn't know about these things. But what he's telling me here is, we understand what's wrong with you. There's not a damn thing I can do for you. We have dumped a truckload of dreck on the medical profession's doorstep and said, fix me. We'll give you the fortune of Midas if you'll just give us the pill. And they keep trying. Bless their hearts. Go to any drugstore. What's the biggest section of any drugstore? By far, weight loss, right? There's no bigger section than the weight loss section, right? Am I right? Okay, all right. Well, what they're telling us is, we cannot help you. There's nothing we can do for you. Many years ago, one of the leading contributors to this book came under our care in this hospital, and while here, he acquired some ideas which he put into practical application at once. Later, he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients here, and with some misgiving, we consented. The cases we have followed through have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men as we have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive, and their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves and still more in the power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death, and that power is God. Of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving. Excuse me. Sorry about that. Craving for liquor, and this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures can be of maximum benefit. And again, when he's saying psychological measures, what we're really thinking here is spiritual awakening as the result of the steps. It's that spiritual awakening. I'm probably not going to have the spiritual awakening if I'm eating 40 candy bars a day. Probably not. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. And again, there's that word allergy, and I'm reminded that this is one of the words that baffled me when I first came in. What are you talking about? Allergy. Why are you saying that? Because I'm eating like 4 football fields of pizza a week, and they're all telling me I can't eat pizza because I'm allergic to it. And what I did not understand is that one of the definitions of allergy is an adverse, abnormal reaction to a food, beverage, or substance. If 9 out of 10 people react to the pizza where they get all the pizza they want when they eat a piece or two, and if my reaction is different from the norm, I am considered to be allergic. You can't see our allergy. You can only feel it. And only a compulsive overeater will feel that allergy. Only a compulsive overeater has that craving racing through their body after the sense of ease and comfort that hits, lasts about 30 seconds, and then you have that craving. Well, they don't get that. They have the same relationship with food as I have the gas in the gas tank of my car. When they drive to the gas station and fill their tank, they don't say to themselves, oh, maybe I should get a little more gas over here. Maybe no one will see me getting any gas. I'll sneak into that gas station over there. No one will see me, right? They don't have those kind of reactions to food either. Because they're normal. They're normal. And they're considered normal because most people are like them. That's why they could never understand why I ate, and I could never understand why they didn't. And the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed a habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. When they say things human, again, we're going to go over this afternoon. On page 60, it says ABC. It says no human power could have relieved my compulsion. Money won't do it. Sex won't do it. Fame won't do it. Fortune won't do it. Poverty won't do it. Only God can alleviate this from my life, because He is the only one more powerful than my ego. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. That means people cannot urge me into this. How many of us have been begged by relatives, please go on a diet, please lose weight. Lose weight, I'll give you a car. Lose weight, I'll give you a boat. Lose weight, I'll give you a wardrobe. Lose weight and do this, and lose weight and don't do that. How many people have been in those situations? And it might have worked for a day or 3 days or a month or 2 months. You got the $100 bill, and what did you do with it? You bought food. Okay. This message, which can interest and hold these alcoholic people, must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their life. It says that the message must have depth and weight. What does that mean? It means you can carry this to the other sick, suffering, compulsive overeaters. This, Rob and Taisha, is it? You can carry this to people where others cannot. You understand them. You understand the pain. You're not speaking to them out of a textbook. You're not going up to their room and saying, put a picture of something on the refrigerator and when you see the picture, you won't eat it. You're speaking to them the language of the heart and the music of the soul. And there are people who are dying and they have experienced tremendous pain. We're going to be talking about that this weekend too. Nobody wakes up in the morning and says, wow, my life is great. I wanted to wake some of you up. Wow, my life is great. Man, everything is coming up roses. I got more money than I can count. Everything is, I look great. I'm going to go join OA. I have yet to meet that person. I have yet to meet that person. But just remember how scared to death you were when you waited out in that parking lot. And you didn't know whether you were going to come in and be one of us or not. And just remember how long it took you to finally come to your first meeting or your second or your seventh. And just remember how fast and how far you ran away from this when you first were exposed to it because you were scared to death. And in your hell, there is great hope. Because you were beat down by this, but not just by this. Because we just read that their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. Some of you have been beat and raped and tortured and emotionally abused. Some of you have been abandoned by the very families you were born into because of your weight. Some of you have been excluded from jobs and promotions because of your weight. Some of you have contemplated suicide. Some of you have tried it. Not just death by candy bar. You didn't come in here because things went well for you. You came in here because of your hell and your torture. You came in here because you had nowhere else to go. And you may be the salvation for that still suffering person. We are spending, and I know I'm under the gun of time, which I'm not usually under the gun of at these things, but today I am because of the nature of this. But I'm just going to say this. You may be someone that God is going to send to save that quivering, scared to death person who walks in here and they don't know where else to go. And they put themselves together and they came out into the night and they got into the car absolutely sure that this was just another diet. that this was just something else that was going to fail, but they were going to try it to prove to their daughter or their friend or someone that this wouldn't work either. And they're going to come and sit next to you. And maybe you're going to share something with them that no one else in this world can share, that you've had that hell too. You can light them up. You can give them something that the diet clubs, the pay and weight places cannot give them. You can give them hope and a reason to come back the next day, and you can give them something. Forget about anything else. You can give them the knowledge that as they go home that night, that they had the experience of sitting next to you, that there was someone who had their pain, someone who understood when no one else in their world understands. No one. Maybe God has that job for you.